coming back to the topic of platform death, is the slow decline but increasingly accelerated one of LinkedIn, and the fact that there is just there's just not very much stuff of value on there anymore. Or maybe I'm doing it wrong, but I'm not seeing stuff interesting.
I don't think you're doing it wrong. I don't think you're holding it wrong. It's, yeah. I'll give you an example, actually. I've just set up an event for my birthday. The amount of reach it got is minuscule. It has nothing to do with how much reach and how easy it was to reach folks, let's say 2-3 weeks ago. Something broke, and I don't know what it is.
So I've just gone on now, and there's a new button at the top where you write your status. That's a worrying button. And
I haven't seen
you now can have start a post, and then beneath it, I don't know what was there before, you have media, you have write article on the right, but in the middle, contribute expertise.
That's the AI stuff.
The AI stuff. So it is pushing it, even that wasn't there. I don't know when it went on, and we're recording this in early April. That I think is new. If I scroll down, I see a repost. I see somebody I am connected with follow something. I see a comment from somebody. I see an ad. I see a comment. I see an ad. I see a promoted post.
Oh no.
Look, there's the AI. There's the AI stuff.
Oh no. Hold on. Funnily enough, I don't have LinkedIn anywhere at the moment.
Well, make it a big internet job, and I actually want to know. I want to know, like, do you want to? I have felt both seen, attacked, and empathized with by my Instagram algorithm recently, which is this understanding that for millennials, we have big internet and we have little internet, and social media is a little internet, it's your phone, right? It's something you need a little internet. Any big purchase is a big internet job. Is a laptop shop. So if I'm booking flights, I am not doing that on my phone. I do my banking on my phone, ironically, but anything where I'm going, I have to book something, that needs a computer. Now, like, I define making something big internet as deleting the app.
That's actually, I like the description, making something big internet is deleting the app, because that's what I did with LinkedIn, right? That's what I did with all of my social media, to be honest with you. I have no social media apps on my phone, but I love that big little internet thing so much. It's so cute. I don't know if that makes me more millennial, because like I'm on the cusp, right? So I'm the last, practically I'm either the last millennial or I'm the first Gen Z. For me, when you said, like, and I think like that's what we were talking about, like booking flights is a big mm-hmm. internet thing. For me, it isn't. I book all of my flights on my phone. I have all of the apps because I want to go travel. Like, obviously, like I have all of my like boarding passes and everything is on my phone. So I just book them from my phone as well. Like that's the logic. It's like, yeah, I just buy the flights from there. I also, like, all of my train journeys, everything happens through the phone. Like, everything travel related is booking, like, you know, hotel booking as well. That also happens on the phone. Funnily enough, I think, like, I guess, like, unlike opposite to most folks, like, all of my social media is on the big internet. it's on the laptop. So I do, like, obviously now LinkedIn is on the laptop. I don't have Instagram, which I think I should go back to for, like, the other thing that I'm doing alongside with Packet Mage, which is, like, I do, like, art classes and you know, the arty stuff. Instagram is big on that, and I'm like, ugh, do I want to go there? I don't know if I want to go there. For example, like, Facebook, because, like, I have, like, a business Facebook page, so that's something I do. I do have Messenger on my phone because that's the way that I talk to my parents, because that's their preferred chat of choice. So that's a little internet. But other than that, I feel like I'm going against the grain here on what's the normal thing that people do. Like, I do all of my serious stuff. I have, for fuck, we were talking about taxes, like, right before we started recording. I have the HMRC app. which is the tax agency in the UK. I have their app on my phone because that's where I look at my tax stuff as well.
Yeah, you see, this is the thing. I do that kind of stuff on my phone, but I think that's because, well, I have mobile. All my banking is done on my 90% of my banking is done on my phone. Some of that is because of the horrendous user experience that I have with internet banking websites, which is just like just not fun at all. But I kind of find myself going, oh well, I can do this on my phone, and I think again it's a user experience thing. But I have culled a lot of my social media. I've not been on Facebook for years. I've used it occasionally for Marketplace, and I don't even really use Messenger anymore. I deleted TikTok because it was a time drain. The problem is I have now basically switched over to Reels and YouTube Shorts, because YouTube, every time I go on YouTube, it pushes Shorts.
Yep. I did delete last night. I deleted YouTube again from my phone.
I think I'm going to have to.
There's no avoiding them. Unfortunately, there's no avoiding them. I can avoid them on like big internet. So, and the browser, yes. you can't have an extension on Chrome that does stop Shorts. It also stops the homepage, which is brilliant because I hate the homepage. So all I want to do is just look at my subscribers, like my subscribe channels. And that is exactly what my YouTube experience is at the moment.
Yeah, that's where I love. The app that I do love now is actually Substack. And that's because it has links to, obviously, the articles that I'm subscribed to and the people that I'm following. It does have a thing called Notes, which is essentially, it was one of those things that happened when Twitter went down the drain and like everyone launched a Twitter clone. But again, it's generally just not many people use it, and it's like, maybe again, it's the kind of people that I follow, and it's just kind of quite nice stuff, and that's nice to use. I tell you what it does. It reminds,
you know, and
it's
does.
It's Twitter like 2009, no,
you
though.
Know, you know what Substack is doing, and I'm now you've put this idea of the gentrification in my head, and I can't help to see this, but
yeah.
When you because I've never installed the Substack app on my phone, so this is the first time. And when you go into log in, it says finally, a place to read your favorite writers in one dedicated space. No ads, no noise, no spam. That's not gonna last long.
I don't. Yeah, the weird thing with Substack is that it already has a monetization.
That's fair.
And it always has had monetization, and maybe they will push ads at some point. I subscribe. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I follow, I subscribe to anyway, so there won't be ads in there. But I think that it's a very different business model to those kinds of apps, and it's a delayed gratification. It's, you know, you go on there and it lists like the people that you follow, their most recent posts. It's like, hey, this is a 10-minute read. This is a 20-minute read. This is something that you need to stop and invest and engage with. And this is something that I'm trying to lean into writing more. And we've talked about this offline. But I've started publishing money. I've published another newsletter last week after 5 months, but I'm finding that it's that thing of I'm wanting to, the more I consume of the stuff I want to produce, the easier it becomes, which might sound like a slightly sort of strange way of putting it, but that's how I'm kind of working.
It will be half an hour of Lydia rants about her emo, half an hour Paul talks about
stuff we can't mention.
Yeah.
Basically.
Like, did you see me like buffer? It's like,
I can just see this. Paul talks about stuff.
Yeah.
I also just don't think it's very interesting. I think, but always say that this is a, and it very much is about a conversation between two people, and we want to, you know, hey Tom, hope you're doing well, by the way. It's been a while since we've given you a shout out. As long as you're like the third. the silent partner in this conversation, you really would get so bored if you listen to what we just... I mean, if they gave a... We was started off today, before we hit record, talking about tax returns and you know, just to give a like a wonderful... It's not like really juicy stuff. It's just probably really tedious. But I was going to say, actually, on the back to... If we think about the reason I like the Substack app, and I would say I originally touched on kind of when I was using it, coming back to the user experience thing as well, right? When I first started subscribing, I was always reading the email newsletters. I now almost exclusively read them in app. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it feels cleaner. It's presented slightly more nicely. And it's a medium-sized internet job. That's an iPad job. That's not a big internet, right? It's not little internet. It's like
okay,
medium.
so we have little, big, and medium. Okay.
Yeah.
So what are medium internet jobs? Like, to me, because like I use the iPad for a very specific purpose. So I don't think I'm a. I think I'm the perfect Apple vision of what the iPad was supposed to be. Right? So what is the iPad supposed to be, Paul? The iPad is a tool for creatives, right? It's a tool that people create artwork, write screenplays, you know, whatever, you know, Steve Jobs was envisioning back in the day. That's me, right? I am that person. Because I grab the iPad, I gingerly place it into my lap. I have the pencil. I have a little glove that I think I was playing but a second ago and now I've misplaced somewhere. Yep, it's on the floor. Hold on. I have a little glove that I don't think Steve Jobs imagined me using, because obviously the iPad would be perfect and not catch my my hand as I'm drawing. But hey, things don't always work that way. So here it is, the little glove, the fingerless glove. It looks very, it's a type of thing that people ask you what's wrong when they see you actually wearing it, because it looks like something that you broke. It looks like you've broken your hand when you do that. Paul, explain to me, what is a, because I don't think you were talking about that when we were talking like medium internet jobs.
No, well, I would say for me, and maybe because I'm currently I use an iPad mini, so it's like it's about the same size as a medium sized book. I use it for reading stuff, whether that's blog articles, whether that's newsletters. I use it for whiteboarding, right? When I'm working, I think, because it's the tool that fits best. Although the problem, the mini is probably a little bit too small to really do what I do. It's not quite enough. It's okay, but it's not great. And I actually use it for watching stuff. So if I'm watching shows, like sitting in bed, watching Succession or whatever other program I'm kind of watching, I do that on the iPad. Because, weirdly enough, I wouldn't watch shorts on the iPad. It feels too big. I don't know why. But I don't know. And that's maybe just thing, but kind of cognitively... And I tell you why, though, is I think it's kind of going, when you're scrolling, you don't sort of, I don't imagine scrolling with my fingers, I imagine scrolling with my thumb. And that is a learnt behaviour, and you can unlearn it, of course. I think the problem I'd have with deleting YouTube on my phone is I use YouTube most heavily for going, how do I do this thing in my house that is probably very basic knowledge, but...
Use your iPad.
Yeah.
Use your iPad.
Yeah.
You can't, unfortunately, on the phone, you cannot control the... Like, you can't remove shorts, right? The problem is the shorts.
No. Yeah. Problem is the shorts.
And if you have identified that you don't have the problem on the iPad, just use the iPad. That's it. Just bring it out. Make it a purposeful thing. By the way, I think you'll be very happy to hear this. Speaking of reading, I have been exclusively reading physical books recently. I don't know if it requires a round of applause.
It does.
I don't think. Hold on. I don't think there's anything innately magical about physical books. There is a thing. They are different. The feeling is different. I skim less, which to me is very important because I am a habitual skimmer. Because I'm, you know. I think it comes from like having to go through a lot of written material. So I have learned to do that in a very unproductive way. So now when I want to, and I guess a lot of the books that I've been wanting to read the last, say, like a couple of weeks have been mostly for my own reading pleasure. And I found myself being very annoyed that I'm skimming it. It's like, why are you skimming this book? This is supposed to be like the philosophies of walking, right? Is one of the weird ones I've picked up recently.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I just want to sit down and enjoy it. And why have I already went through 10 pages? Like, stop, slow down. there's something about the physicality of it that makes me slow down versus reading on the iPad or my phone. Which, by the way, I don't think I've actually ever read on my phone, like, a proper book. Again, I skimmed on my phone. I haven't read on my phone. Do you skim? I would imagine you're very fast as a reader, but do you actually do, like, the fast reading technique of, like, skimming, like, horizontally, you know, whatever, like, not horizontally, but, like, diagonally and doing the thing? And
no, I think the closest I've come to is when I'm reading for purely for information. It's the thing of like holding like a ruler underneath the lines and moving it down the page.
Right.
So obviously like normally you pick up a book and you read it from top to bottom, but it's like you take it, you put, you can do it with a pen. You put it underneath the first line and you just move the line down and you slowly, and you line by line, you move it down. I do that very occasionally. I remember, and again, this is when the Harry Potter books were kind of coming out, and there's this whole thing about who's going to read them first, and there was like there would be vox pops on TV of like people putting their finger in the middle of the book and reading down that way, and like tracing and like trying to speed read stuff. So I would say that I skim documents because I can go find that information out. I don't tend to skim books. Because if I'm reading a book, it's primarily going to be something I'm doing for pleasure. And I think this is actually interesting. I don't really read books for any reason other than pleasure. So I'm not reading a book for self-improvement. Right. I might read a book that I think, hey, this is interesting. But if I'm not enjoying it, it becomes a real slog.
Yeah.
So business books... yeah, I'll read them, but I won't kind of go, I'm reading this book because I want to get something better out of it. And it's the same thing with like podcasts, right? I don't listen to podcasts purely for the sake of like finding something to improve. I'm going, I find this interesting, and if I get something helpful out of it, hey, great. That's useful. But my kind of sweet spot with that stuff is that one that is a mixture of useful information, maybe helpful guidance. So I have a complex relationship with self-help books, and I hate that term, because a lot of the time, this is a real general, this is in my experience, a lot of the self-help books I've read state very obvious things and then kind of sprinkle it in a little bit of dust, of gold dust, and you go, oh, that's a really useful takeaway. But 90% of it, I'm like, you're saying the same thing 100 times over.
Yes.
In a different way.
Yeah. It's the same story written for 10 different characters. That's the way I position it. In that case, have you used and have you come across Blinkist?
I have come across... well, I've seen it advertised a whole lot.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, it's basically Cliff Notes, but an audio or an app version.
I'm trying to figure out if things like Blinkist can fill in that need to figure out what the golden nugget is in these self-help books. Because the thing with Blinkist that I agree with you, right? So first of all, like, yeah, let me state that. I agree with you that quite a lot of what we consider self-help, productivity, whatever you want to call it, like that sort of non-fiction improvement books, they have one or two really good ideas, which could have been a blog post or a Blink, right? Which is the short like resumes that Blinkist people actually create. So that's what I was thinking over time. I haven't really found it useful yet, because the books that they recommend to me, as someone who obviously doesn't listen to a lot or read a lot of Blinks, Because there's so many, right? So it's obviously using some sort of algorithm trying to imagine what is the things that I would be interested in. It hasn't hit anything interesting yet for me to actually click on and say like, oh yeah, I want to read about this. Might be because I'm in a weird mood when it comes to books at the moment, because if I have to read another self-help / productivity book right now, I think I'm going to stop reading overall. not to be dramatic, but, you know. I'm finding myself very much to be into history at the moment. So, you know, hint, hint, if you want to buy me some books.
That's fine. Yeah.
By the way, I've never asked you this, and too little too late maybe. Fiction?
Yes.
Fancy?
Yeah, not as much as I would like.
Okay, good. That's a good answer.
Put it this way, I have tried on... So one of my best friends from university, he was my best man. He is like very high intellect, PhD in literature. His favourite book series of all time was the Wheel of Time series.
Oh, goodness.
So,
oh.
He was reading them as they were coming out, kind of.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, you know, I would go, he now lives in Canada, and we would go, whenever he was going, we would go into a bookshop and he would be like, right, what are the three books that Brandon Sanderson has published this month? Because he's just getting told off. I just accidentally wrote a 1,000 page epic. No, so I would say yes, I grew up with Lewis and Tolkien, and the internet is telling me to rewatch Lord of the Rings. I actually saw a video the other day that was someone positioning a film series, a three-part series about hobbits, right? And oh, we had the Hobbit. No, this is entirely set in the Shire. So like the first 20 minutes of Fellowship of the Ring, it's just that. And it's just hobbits just going about their day. And I was like, I would read that. I would watch that. So yes, fantasy, and I say my fiction veers between fantasy, not enough of it, some graphic novels, crime, sort of murder mystery, like classic like P.D. James, Agatha Christie type stuff, and then more literary stuff. Things like Haruki Murakami and Paul Auster. So I kind of vary, and I read a lot of fiction when I was studying, like a lot of fiction, and I have a kind of weird relationship. I actually listen to more fiction than read.
Yes, I agree completely. Can I explain my reaction to the Wheel of Time?
Yeah, it's fine. I get it. Yeah.
I just looked it up, right? The ready set is 15 books, and it's not all encompassing, right? But like you can buy the Wheel of Time set, which is 15 books. So like let's use that as an idea. To me, the Wheel of Time is like nerd homework. It feels like one of those things that every self-proclaimed nerd has it on the back of their head of like, I really need to get that done. Like it's like sitting there looking at you. My dad has read like the entirety of it. I think that was the right way to do it, like as it was coming out, and in his case, like as it was being translated into Bulgarian. So, and also, side note, translation from English to Bulgarian, like, or to any language really, it's such an art form. Like I just want to like, oh. I love. There was like, especially like when I was growing up, there was like a group, I think, of translators in Bulgaria that were taking like humongous works of art, like the Wheel of Time, like Terry Pratchett, like, who is, by the way, Terry Pratchett, incredibly British. How the heck do you translate humor like that? They managed. I don't know how. I have read side by side the Bulgarian translation and an English translation of the English original of Terry Pratchett's books, and I'm just like, Mort was the one I was doing the most recently, and it was two completely different books.
Mm-hmm.
Purposefully, because you cannot translate humor, you have to write it your own.
Yes.
So like, why do we call them translators? They should be just writers.
Yes, I agree. And my favorite example of that is actually in film, and is the Miyazaki films.
Yeah,
they're completely different. in English and in the original Japanese. Like, they are, and I think in translation is you have to maintain the spirit of it.
Yes.
Because you can't take ridiculous. The words. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I don't know. I've not read a great deal of Terry Pratchett. I read, I think there were two books he wrote that were not Discworld that I read.
Yeah.
And I thought were hilarious. And I never just got into that. I grew up in that point when Harry Potter, Harry Potter was the books that got me into reading. Ironically, up until I was about 9, I did not read. I hated reading.
I did not read it either growing up.
Like, wouldn't. And then I think it was around about the time that the third Harry Potter book came out.
Reading. How old was that? How old were you?
Prisoner of Azkaban. So I must have been... I'm going to have to look this up.
Because I wonder if it was a similar sort of age point that you and I started reading feverishly.
When was The Prisoner of... See, all the stuff that comes up, and this bugs me. It's all the first results, all about the film.
Well...
Okay, 99. There you go. So I was around like 9 or 10 when I first reading. Yeah. And I know that because also... I think that's actually at my parents' house. But books 1, 2 and 3 are all soft covers. The rest of them are all hard covers. So... essentially, the first three books I kind of read a year or so after they came out because they were already publishing them in the paperback. Then I was always buying them when they were coming out in hardback. Now, I have quite a problematic relationship with those books now. And looking back as someone who has young children, I am unsure about whether or not I'll read them to them because... There's so many issues with those books. And not getting into an art and the artist conversation, because that is going so far off the conversation. Yeah. But I think, I think it's what did it for me was, that was the first time I was like, oh, I'm actually enjoying, I can visualise this. And then I remember the films coming out and I was like, that's not how it looks. Yeah. But...
I have a shameful confession to make.
What's that?
I wish my first sort of getting really into books was Harry Potter. I really wish it was.
What was your first getting into books?
Can you try to guesstimate based on, I was 12, 13, so that's like 2000.
Was it the Twilight series?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know what? I love those. I love those films.
I think that so nowadays, okay. Unapologetically have reread the first book. Mm-hmm. It is so bad.
Oh,
it's
horrific.
But it's a guilty pleasure sort of bad of like, oh, this is how fan fiction was, like, most fan fiction was back in the day of like, the fan fiction era. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's fine if that's what you're looking for. But goodness. Yeah, no. So I have very fond memories of... So I really struggled getting into books, mostly because a lot of the books that I was, given to read were Bulgarian literature, which is quite hardcore. Like classic Bulgarian literature. There were some kids' books, of course. I do have some fond memories of them, but they were like two books maybe out of like whatever, like 30, 40 that my parents tried. My parents never forced me into anything like that because they were very clear that if they forced me into something, I'm going to hate it. So, but they did present me a lot of options. Let me just for clarity, it wasn't like I didn't read, but I didn't read books. So I was reading a lot of encyclopedias, like looking at pretty pictures. Like I was definitely a very visual kid versus like actually reading. I could read from a very young age. That wasn't the issue there. It's just I wasn't interested in books any way, shape or form. They were boring to me. Even when my parents were trying to... And I say this now because in comparison to when I was growing up, my sister, dad reads her books and she loves it. Right. Mm-hmm. She is very much of she takes in audio and text format better than I have ever taken in until later on in my kid life. So I have very fond memories of me going to school with the first Twilight book, a big honk of a book, like a brick, in English, right? So I think that was the thing in my brain, because I started speaking Bulgarian and English at about the same time, which is a whole different topic, by the way. At some point, maybe we'll talk about that, how the heck did that happen with two Bulgarian parents who only spoke Bulgarian, but hey. So I think it was the first English book I had, and I think that was really the point where it's like, oh, English is the language for reading. Now I enjoy this part. And I never, even nowadays, I still don't enjoy reading in Bulgarian. I enjoy reading in English. Unless, obviously, like, I do have a couple of books that are original. Like, if I would read it in the original language, of course, I'll read it in the original language. So I will do that. But there are maybe two or three Bulgarian books that I've ever read because of that I have chosen to read rather than being forced upon me from school. But yeah, so that was really, like, Twilight was my gateway drug into reading books, and I was a lot more shameful of it before. Nowadays, I have like this sort of guilty pleasure thing of like, oh, it's so bad that it's somehow good.
So I'm gonna say, and I can't take credit, there's a very famous radio DJ in the UK called Simon Mayo, and he has a real problem with the phrase guilty pleasure, and I kind of get it. And he's like, if it's something you enjoy, you shouldn't feel guilty about it. Now I understand what, because my coming back to YouTube, like we talk about YouTube, it's not always YouTube shorts, it's the like movie snippets and the movie clips. And it's like, I'm gonna go and sit and like watch my favorite bits from The Thing, or it's the kill count videos, and it's like just all the deaths in a horror movie. And I'm like, is that a guilty pleasure? Maybe, but if you enjoy it, but I get it, right?
I agree, like, with the whole, like, it shouldn't be guilty out of a pleasure. I guess my problem with, like, things like Twilight is that it's practically the same as, like, trash TV, right? Where it's like, it's not great, but, you know, like, what was it? It's like, the Housewives of Beverly Hills, right? Like, stuff like that, which, like, reality TV, right? Or Watch the Kardashians or whatever people do, right? To me, reading and watching Twilight and things like that is on that same level, because I know it's bad. There is nothing of value here. It doesn't inspire or enrich me in any way, shape, or form. Quite the opposite. But it does provide that outlet for, like, I just need something cheap and cheerful. It's like a takeaway. It's the takeaway version of books. That's what it is.
It is. It is. And it is allowing you to just enjoy the medium. And you know what? That's absolutely fine. And I'm kind of just going, you know what, just do what you enjoy. Quick mention of Twilight, and I have actually got something else, to another topic to that I want to discuss with you. Twilight, the fourth film, the best twist in a film, because I did not know that was coming. When it's the end, so like, I knew that, and spoiler alert for a film that came out 10 years ago, a book that came out 15 years ago, more than that, I don't know when. Essentially, there's this big setup, there's going to be a big battle, and it looks like, and in the book, I've not read the books. Apparently, there's just this kind of conversation, and there's a character who can project what will happen, and she's like, if we do this, everyone dies, basically. The way they did it in the movie was really clever, because it's really like cliche, but also really clever, because it makes it look like it happens, you know, all the main characters are all getting their heads ripped off and all dying, and then it's like, surprise, she was just showing what would have happened. It was the dream. The third, I think, Twilight film is a full-on horror movie, and it was actually directed by a guy who made a film called 30 Days of Night, which is an excellent vampire movie. The end of the fourth one, traumatized. Properly, like, you don't see very much, but that is a lesson in sound design. Okay, you know, there's just like,
oh, we could talk about horror for a long while, because what you just said there about, like, it's all about sound design, I'm not a big fan of horror. Like, I get really... Mm-hmm. Like, I get spooked very easily. Like, I cannot mm-hmm. play horror video games. I cannot watch... I can barely watch people play horror games because I just start... I'm not... Like, my... I think I have way too much... Like, my brain just starts, like, you know, going haywire. Like, I start hearing things in the dark after I watch a horror movie. I'm not great for that. But the horrors that, like... And that's why I'm saying it's almost never about the gore. It's almost never about like the icky parts of a horror movie. It's that suspense of the unknown and not showing what has actually happened, which it's the real indication of a good horror, both for books, mm-hmm. games, mm-hmm. movies, etc. That's why at the moment, I think a lot of Korean and Japanese like horror movies are peak, you know, mm-hmm. horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, they don't create some sort of disgusting, gory monster and show it to you. It's like, no. You never see what's out there. Right? And that's the scary part.
Or if they do, and this is a Korean film I watched last year. So it's Korean, called The Sadness.
Mm.
Which manages to kind of do both. And the premise of it, and I will link the trailer in the show notes, but I will put a very heavy warning on it. The trailer is, well, anyway, I think it's worth it. Essentially, it's the premise is, it's kind of a, not a zombie film, but it's a virus that means that people give in to their, whatever is it called, that part of your brain that's like, the irrational part of your brain that's like, if you're on a bridge, hey, I'm going to throw my phone over the side.
Right.
Intrusive thoughts.
Right.
And the scary part of it is it's like, there's nothing supernatural about it. The whole premise being, this is just what everyone's thinking they want to do, and now they don't have, it's a very, very thin explanation, which is basically just a way of going, this is how we're going to justify what is an exceptionally gory film, but it's all to do with like, oh no, the part of your brain that stops you doing that? Yeah, that's gone now.
Right. Fantastic.
Anyway.
That sounds awful.
No, the thing I wanted to just kind of ask you about, and we talked about this, I think very early on when we started in the podcast, and we're still early on, but episode one or two, is this idea, Lydia, have you heard of the soft life? The trend for the soft life. Does it
focus
sound nice?
Living a soft life. Focus on what's important. Yeah. Focus on what's important. Taking care of yourself. Having a little garden. Having, you know, not worrying about kumbaya, right? Everyone's dancing in the sunshine.
Yeah.
Walks in nature. Woo!
I mean, it is a bit like that.
It is one of those moments where I wish this was a video podcast.
So do I, because that was an excellent moment.
Oh, well.
But the I mean, yeah, that's kind of what it is.
No, do give the proper explanation, because I was just being...
I can give the proper explanation. So the proper explanation is this idea that rather than kind of pursuing the rat race, pursuing kind of endless success, always getting an edge. And I think it's a very much a generational thing of, you know, I was certainly brought up to take pride in work and work hard and you will be successful. And kind of macro events in the world have kind of shown that whatever you do, that isn't necessarily a guarantee and everything's chance. It's actually about, on the one hand, learning to live within your means, but also... just thinking about what is the life that you actually want to lead and setting up the relationship you have with the work that you do and the aspirations you have around that job and that career to really align with living a kind of more fulfilling life, I guess. And there's some quite extreme examples, and I'll link a piece in the show notes that goes into more detail. And it takes some quite extreme examples of people who essentially just go from living in a big city in a job that they hate to moving back home and like running a small part-time business. And I think that is like the kind of the one extreme of it. But I think there's also a point where, and I think it's interesting, particularly in tech and technology, where there's a conflict between uber success, make loads and loads of money, continue to push, continue to succeed, and actually going, well, what about the relationship? What about everything else? And I don't know. I look at that and go, yeah, I can see the appeal of that, but I also can see it's a bit like it's almost idealistic in its own way.
It is.
Because you're saying this is something that you can do, and it's like, yeah, but you're assuming that you can be in a position to do that.
Yeah. You're assuming everyone has, you're assuming everyone is single, doesn't have kids, doesn't have anything, has no debts, has no nothing looming over their heads, where we can't just drop everything and go back home and even have a home to go back to. Mm-hmm. Right? So a lot of assumptions there. I promise it's not a cop-out, but I think with a lot of these movements, the truth is always somewhere in the middle. And there's a couple of things that, you know, reading that article and just having a couple of conversations with folks around this on this topic, there's a couple of things happening here, I believe. The first part is this is a very strong response, but actually it's quite mild response to a crisis that a lot of people went through over COVID. I think this is still an echo of what folks experienced over those, you know, couple of very traumatic years for a lot of people. The refocus, the reshuffle, the re-engagement with other parts of your life when work just crumbled. That doesn't mean it's sustainable, mind you. You know, the world needs to carry on. But I think this is still those echoing crisis responses that folks are having of like, none of this mm-hmm. matters. Everything that I do in this office doesn't matter. There must be something more. This must mean something else above than, you know, just what I'm doing in the office. What I think is also happening here is a level of burnout, especially mm-hmm. you mentioned tech. I think tech in particular is very heavy when it comes to this. A huge amount of folks are being overworked, there's a huge level of expectations put on of a huge amount of young people as well coming into tech because of this promise of fancy offices and security and job security and everything else, which is also now crumbling to bits because it's April and just the amount of layoffs, the rate of layoffs is not going down, it's continuing if anything. So this is really a response, right? It's nothing new mm-hmm. as well, by the way. Like, I believe in a lot of things in life come in ebbs and flows, in the sense of like, oh, we're going to be ultra focused on one thing, then we're going to ease out. Ultra focused on the thing, easing out. This feels like an easing out, in the sense of, have we spent the last sort of 5 to 10 years as a society really focusing on getting people in the office, getting them as productive as possible, building up a lot of the businesses and a lot of the money makers in the world. Again, the technological boom, maybe, you know, 20 years ago. This is really the ebb of people pulling back a little bit and saying like, yeah, we've spent, you know, and especially people like in their 40s and 50s is like, we've spent our lives building this system up. But funnily enough, it's not those same people that are not ebbing out. It's actually their kids who have seen them put everything into this system, getting nothing in return and going like, do I want to do that? I'm one of these people, yeah. Right? Like, I don't want to say like I'm a, what was it? Like a soft lifer?
Yeah, or a lazy girl. Lazy girl
lazy
job.
Girl, yeah, lazy girl job. Like, not at all, right?
No.
But I am in that position, and I think this is really important to state in this conversation. I am in that position where I could take a step back and say, look, listen, I burned out quite a bit working in tech. I want to step away and just see what life actually has to do. Because like, I haven't stopped working since, you know, I got into uni. So this was my opportunity to take a step back and sort of reconnect Mm-hmm. whatever this sort of, you know, airy fairy words are when it comes to this topic, but really recognize what is important to me, which I think is really what these, you know, a lot of these articles are referring to here. You said, like, you know, people who are going back to their parents and, you know, getting up small part-time businesses. It's like, yeah, doing something they enjoy, being around people that they, you know, love and want to cherish and want to spend some more time as they, especially as they're growing older. I completely get that.
Mm.
Is it for everyone? No, not at all. Does it make you bad that you're not doing it? No, not at all. What do you think? First of all, do you think I'm one of these? Is that what you brought
no,
up?
No, I don't think I'm one of these. No, I sent it to you because I think we'd obviously had these conversations about it, and I think you said that, you know, you'd spent last year traveling all the time, trying to do all this stuff, and you're like, I need to reassess where I am in life and what I want to do. So that's why I think what's interesting for me is I look at my own career trajectory and my own career ambitions, and the overriding kind of thing for me is that, yes, I want to continue to be successful, I want to continue to grow, but I always want to be home for dinner.
Yeah,
is how I put it. And I think that's for me what it is. And it's like, I am, and there's been a few things that crystallize this, you know, it's you I repeated, everyone's like, ah, when you're older, the only people that remember that you worked late are your family, you know, none of this. I can just hear it. I never can talk louder. None of this kind of matters. None of this is relevant to what you're doing. And I think it's important in the moment, and it's important because you give it value and because you go, this is important to me. And I think it's a couple of things to it for me. One of them is, you should be in a, if you are fortunate enough to be in this position, you should be in a position where you're in a job that you get some fulfillment out of. Now, I'm not saying you should love every day that you turn up to work, because no one does, right? And it's kind of unhealthy if you do, actually. But you should at least see the value in what it is you're doing. But I also think that this is really, I think you're right that COVID's a part of it. I think it goes back further than that. I mean, I started uni the year of the 2008 financial crash. So I graduated into like a recession and there was nothing. And for some of my friends, they still are like, well, they've sort of chosen a softer life. Like a good friend of mine from college, she was very, very bright, very clever. She has now, I think, spent 10 years, and she's the curator, I would say, of a small museum, but she loves it, right? And she enjoys her job. And I think it's actually, for me, about the, it's a reminder to always look at things in the round. And every career decision that I make and every move that I make is always one that I'm doing, not in an isolation. I'm not going, well, how does this thing impact my career growth? I'm going, how does this decision I'm about to make impact what I want to do every day? And I have a problem with people that go, well, here's how, when I was really successful, I managed my life by just not, you know, not looking at emails after 5 o'clock, and you just don't do it. And it's so easy to go, yeah, I just don't do it. And it's like, but that's not possible for everybody. Mentally, it's not possible to do. But also, that just isn't something that is actually possible to do. But I think what it, for me, is about is kind of going, I am in this position right now, things are moving in a direction I didn't expect them to move in, but in my experience, things have always worked out. You know, there's always a, I don't know, get too a bit too airy fairy, oh, everything happens for a reason. But if I look back at the last sort of 12 years of my professional life, every time something's happened that I've gone, whoa, I'm not ready for this, or I didn't expect that to happen, I go, well, if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be where I am now, and I am really happy with where I am now.
Do you also think that a lot of this sort of unfocusing from a traditional career is because there is no traditional career anymore? I sort of mentioned offhandedly, like, you know, all the layoffs and everything. And I think for a lot of, especially for a lot of young folks, I know for a lot of my colleagues within VMware, for example, them leaving VMware was the first time they were really faced with this, oh, tech, there's nothing secure in tech, right? They can just lay you off like that. It's like, yeah, they all do, right? It's a norm. Right, they see like slews of people from Microsoft, they see slews of people from all over the place just being laid off. And that's it. You're on your own. Go figure it out. And again, that's why I keep on saying that I think this sort of approach to choosing a life path or a life goal, or this is a response to seeing what the world looks like right now.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely a response. And I think not to be too dramatic, on some level it's a trauma response, because we're kind of kicking back against everything that's happened, and COVID's been a part of that. Absolutely, COVID's a part of that. And I think, as you said, when lockdown happened and like we were reduced to the absolute barest experience of life, we're now reassessing what's important to us. But I think in tech, what that means is you just have to be so mindful. And burnout is a perennial thing everyone talks about. Everyone always talks about burnout. Absolutely, burnout is a part of it. But you also just need to be making sure that you're kind of ensuring that you're putting yourself in a place where you want to be.
I have a funny thing, by the way, about burnout. I think burnout is avoidable within tech. I've been speaking to folks around, you know, like, you know, oh no, it's just the speed of development, right? It's just like we're developing things so quickly. So many things are happening that it's unavoidable, right? I disagree, because why wasn't this such a big thing back in, you know, the .com era, right? When Microsoft was kicking off, when Apple was kicking off, when all of this was kicking off, why was this not such a Why were people not dropping off like flies in the offices? Some were still, don't get me wrong, it's not an exception. But there was something in how technology was being developed that let people take a breath in. I was talking to someone around game development, right? So game development 10, 15 years ago was completely different than game development nowadays. Nowadays, there is no stop. There is no end. There is no cycle, right? There was a term called development cycle. We still use it, right? But in reality, there isn't really one. There isn't a cycle. It's just an ever-ending stream of people working on stuff day in and day out. So of course, burnout is going to be a consequence of that. There used to be a lot more of a natural rhythm within tech, because we weren't expected to have, you know, we're talking about, because developers is sort of like where it all starts, and everyone, you know, we as sellers within a software development company, we're sort of like following through with the development cycle. When developers develop something, obviously then it needs to be marketed, needs to be sold, etc., etc. So it all starts with them. They're the core of this time frame of the seasonality that used to exist, and it doesn't anymore. And I wonder if the numbers, and I'm sure there has to be a thing somewhere that says, like, you know, oh yeah, no, we see now a drop in productivity, more productivity, because if it worked before, why did we break it? What caused this to change? Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen this?
I know what you mean. Yeah, and it is, and it does seem to be, and I think it's the same in any business. It's like it's a continuous, it's like a production line, just stuff, more. And I kind of think there's, ironically, needs to be some kind of, there's a role that the AI is clearly playing in that. But I also, I'm looking at it and just going, you can summarize it, ha ha ha, using physics, which is that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And I think this rise of like soft life influencer is a reaction and a kickback, not just to the everything we've been talking about in the world, but also to this kind of like the last couple of years. And I think certainly what happened in business and in technology between like 2021 and 2023 was this like rise in hustle culture. It's like rise and grind and make money, and the really toxic stuff that's like, I never cook because cooking is a waste of time, and I can make more money by, like, it's more productive for me to be working than it is to be cooking. And I'm like, but cooking's great. reading trashy books can be great, and not every bit of the day has, and I'm getting into rap, but it's that, I think that's also what it is it's a kickback against, as you say, I think you're right, that it's the ebb and the flow, and it's the balance, the perpetual balancing of people going, well, we're going to go really hard one way, and I do think that this is a shift back away from the, something that I think really happened, it's like kind of really started, I think, in the 80s, 90s, aughts. As you say, the technology made it easier to do more with less. And we're now seeing a pushback, a generational pushback against that. People going, I watched my parents work for 40 years and then get laid off with statutory redundancy. So why would I pour my whole self into it? And I think that that's not to say... It's, and again, we could talk for a long time about why quiet quitting is a horrendous thing and you shouldn't do it. And that's not at all what I'm suggesting. It's just about assessing that relationship that you have and looking at everything in the round, looking at your work as a part of what you do and who you are and what your day makes up, and making time for the stuff that matters. Because you can. If you want to, you can.